Shrink Wrap Radio number 297, Engineering Happiness with Dr. Rakesh Sareen.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Rakesh Sareen, UCLA Management Professor and co-author of the book Engineering Happiness, A New Approach for Building a Joyful Life. To learn more about Dr. Sareen, please consult our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Rakesh Sareen, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dave. It is a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, it's a pleasure for me, especially because I've been reading and enjoying your book, Engineering Happiness, A New Approach for Building a Joyful Life, which you co-authored with Manel Bousels. Am I saying his name correctly?
That's correct.
Yeah, and your book is delightful and provocative. And one of the most provocative things about it is that it's written by two engineers.
Right.
And as you know, there's been a rash of books on happiness since Martin Seligman's announcement of the field of positive psychology back in 1998. And most of those books have been written by psychologists. So it's somehow shocking to find two engineers weighing in on this topic. And I like the way you put it in your preface where you say, quotes, "Perhaps you're thinking, what can two pointy-headed math geeks possibly teach me about happiness?"
Right.
So, what's your answer to that question?
Okay, so Dave, Manel and I have been working for a long time on what we call decision analysis, why people choose A over B. And apparently people choose A over B because A makes them happier than B would. So we started thinking, what are the mechanisms that trigger happiness in people? And we said that engineers have built all these wonderful things, skyscrapers and airplanes and iPhones. And could we use the similar approach, which is quantifying things, organizing all the fact and empirical data, and come up with some laws that guide our happiness? And in this book, we put together our 10 years of research, and we are able to say that, yes, there are some systematic ways by which happiness is created or destroyed or maintained. And I'm happy to talk to you about those.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that. And parenthetically, I should let you know that I had originally planned to be an engineer myself.
Oh, good.
I was accepted into the University of Pennsylvania into an electrical engineering program, but I switched out after not too long. And also, I'm very interested in the whole, that whole field of decision. How did you describe it?
Decision analysis.
Decision analysis. I interviewed another of your, I guess countryman would be the right way, Sheena Iyengar.
Right.
I'm sure you're aware of her work.
Right. Yes, I am. Yes.
And also the Israeli guy whose name I'm blocking on now. Who's
Maybe Dan Ariely?
Yes, yes.
Yes. So it is a big community, and we all work on very similar problems, mm-hmm. but we have a little different take. Some of the people, like Sheena and Dan, they look at a lot of empirical data, and Manel and I try to build theory. So we look at the data and try to organize it with some guiding principles and use a more mathematical thing. Even though the book is written in for general public, it has no mathematics, but the ideas that come to us come out of mathematics.
Yes, no potential readers should be scared away. Because it's a very readable book.
Right, and it has a lot of stories and examples on how we can choose to be happy.
Yeah, yes. Speaking of choice, well, I was struck by the assertion that, and again, quotes, the very essence of attaining a happier life is choice.
Yes.
And that's a point of view that would be fundamental to existential philosophy and psychology, and not necessarily what I'd expect in a chapter titled The Science of Happiness. I was surprised to encounter that, because I happen to believe choice is very important as well.
Right, right. So basic point, Dave, that we have is you could have two views of life. One is what I could say is a pendulum. That means some days we are happy and some days we are not happy, mm-hmm. but we have a set point and ultimately it comes back to the same thing. And there is some truth to it. In fact, one scientist did say that trying to be happier is as futile as trying to be taller, and therefore it is counterproductive. But we have a different view. We feel that happiness is more like a sailboat. Yes, ocean currents and the wind influence a sailboat, but you have the control of the rudder and you can guide it to some degree. So we are relatively strong in this point that regardless of your circumstances, regardless of where you are in the world, where you are in your lives, you can choose to be happy. And by choice, we mean is not suddenly say, let me be happy today, even though that could help, but really make certain life choices, certain choices about how you think about the world, how you examine your own inner life, and those choices would make you happy. So happiness is not some kind of a destination. It is more like organizing our life so that we have more happier and more positive state of minds and less negative thoughts and less negative states of mind. That's what it is for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you say that happiness is not a destination, and I have the impression that, in fact, it might be a mistake to focus on happiness per se rather
right.
than on some other things that, as a byproduct, happen to produce happiness.
You are totally right. That's what we believe, that we make certain choices, and those choices, the byproduct will be happiness. And we will talk about some of those as we go along. But that's right. So it is not a direct thing. It is not just control the thermostat and put it on higher happiness. It is an indirect, a byproduct of the way we live our life.
Yes. Now, you point out that your co-author was raised in Spain as a Catholic, and you grew up in India as a Hindu.
Yes.
Yet the two of you are persuaded that there are universal principles that govern happiness, even for two people from such disparate cultures.
Yes.
Say a little bit about that. We'll get into your laws later, but just say a little something broad.
So the basic thing is that what we feel is that ultimately all human beings have emotions, feelings, states of mind. And to us, happiness is simply the sum total of positive and negative emotions and states of mind. And even though the background, certain things could be a little more hurtful in one culture than other, but nevertheless, fundamentally, we are very similar. And similar things give us joy when we spend time with friends, whether you are from the US or India or Spain, you enjoy it. And if some bad things happen in life, it hurts wherever you are from. So yes, certain triggers of happiness may be somewhat different for different cultures, but the basic mechanisms are very similar because all human beings at that level are very alike.
Okay. Now, science is all about measurement, control, and prediction. So it's fitting that you start off talking about measuring happiness, and you outline six approaches to measuring happiness. So maybe we can kind of step through those six approaches because it's so fundamental to the whole discussion.
Right. So there is a lot of progress in measuring happiness, because at first blush it seems like happiness is some internal state of a person. How could we ever measure it? But scientists have made a lot of progress, psychologists, economists, and now even neuroscientists on measuring happiness. So I would say it is still not as precise as measuring your height and weight, but we can get very good data. So the approaches we describe really are our analysis of literature and what people have used. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the most popular approach, because it is easier, is simply to ask people, let's say on a 0 to 10 point scale, how happy they are with their lives. But some other people have come up with more elaborate scales to measure happiness. So asking people is one way. The other way is to look at the experience utility. So this is Csikszentmihalyi pioneer, where basically you tell the experimenter how happy you are feeling, or how anxious you are, or how stressed out you are, or how cheerful you are, and they will take all that information and combine it into a scale. So that is another method, and that method is particularly good because it does not depend on the recall or a projection, because we are neither very good in recalling nor we are very good in projecting, but we are very good in telling people how we are feeling right now. So if you and I, for example, I'm having a good time having conversation with you, then my happiness, or we call it happy dance, will be 9 points. And if suppose at some other point during the day I get an annoying email, then it may be 5 or 6. So you see, it fluctuates over time. So experience sampling method tries to measure that. And then people have done studies of diaries. They look at some extreme measures like suicide rates. They look at body measurements. And now the new technique that has been pioneered by neuroscientists is neuroimaging. Basically, they look at the activity in our prefrontal cortex on the left side and the right side. And basically what it is if left side is more active, then we are cheerful, and right side is more active, then we are not so cheerful, or maybe even depressed. And that measure, Davidson, neuroscientist, has used to study monks.
Richie Davidson. I've also interviewed him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead though.
So he has studied monks and other people, and someday they may be handheld devices that are measuring happiness of people on some continuous basis, like we can measure blood pressure. It fluctuates during the day, but we can measure it, and happiness similarly can be measured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was one of the most intriguing propositions, because I'm a big iPhone user and advocate, and so it certainly is possible that the iPhone can do so much already.
Right.
It doesn't seem like it's that big a jump to think that, well, maybe you could have a Bluetooth set on your scalp and it could measure the differential between the signals.
Right. So that day is not very far. But until then, we have millions of pieces of data from all over the world that researchers have collected. So we know a lot about what makes people happy, what makes people unhappy, in what circumstances people are happier, in what circumstances they are not so happy. And our point was that all this information is a bit haphazard and disorganized. So our laws of happiness is our way of organizing all of the information and then concluding what are the mechanisms that give rise to happiness. So in a way, you could say that there is not so much new, frankly, in our book. What is new is this organizing principle. And once you begin to think like that, you see lots of opportunities to improve your happiness.
Yes, in fact, that was my impression as well, that I was reading a very well-organized summary of the findings of positive psychology. And
yes,
so just very useful at that level. And I suppose before we go any further in our discussion, I should ask you, you know, and maybe you already said this actually earlier, but we can just say it again. Your definition of happiness, so that people understand as we discuss this, just what you mean when you say happiness.
Okay, so our definition is that it is the total sum over time of momentary emotions, feelings, and states of mind. So to us, happiness is not some mysterious concept. It is basically trying to see most of the time we want to be happy and fewer occasions we want to have negative feelings or states of mind. So it is simply the total sum of pleasure minus pains, if you want to put it that way. But of course, most of the time it is not pleasure and pain. It is our state of mind, our feeling, our emotion. So it is simply the total sum. And so if you want to improve the total sum of happiness, then what you want to do is to increase the frequency and duration of the positive and reduce the negative. It's as simple as that. But the question is, what gives rise to these positive emotions, what gives rise to these negative emotions, and that's where laws come in.
Well, it seems to me that some people might think that that was too simplistic a definition, and the example that comes to mind is people may be engaged in certain forms of, let's say, political activism that are not necessarily pleasurable in the hedonistic sense, but are very meaningful. So that they feel like they're having a fulfilling life, even though they may be undergoing all sorts of privations and difficulties.
Right. So, you see, one cannot just, first of all, look at a small slice of time. When you are asking a child to practice piano, the child may be frustrated. So that experience in itself for a short duration may be somewhat stressful. But if you look at a longer duration, then the same child, once he develops some skill, begins to appreciate playing piano and enjoys it. So, yes, you are right. The definition, if narrowly viewed, is simplistic, but if we take it overall view, we have a whole chapter called Cumulative Good on Seeing Meaning in Life, and where we talk about these kinds of things that you are talking about, setting goals, making progress toward goals, whether they are political or they are environmental or they could be spiritual. And sometimes in the process of attaining those goals, there are harder times, there are difficult times. But nevertheless, if we view it as a cumulative good, then overall, overall we come out happier, we feel more satisfied. So I would say that if you look at our entire book, these issues of meaningfulness, and we quote from Viktor Frankl in the Cumulative Good chapter, who has emphasized this, and Csikszentmihalyi, who has emphasized flow idea. Of course, we see from daily life, we are engaged in something. It is not pleasure of the kind like eating ice cream, but we lose sense of time. And that to us is a happiness, because we have a positive state of mind and we are lost in things that we are enjoying.
Yes. Now, you propose a set of six laws of happiness, and I'll just enumerate them here. One, relative comparison. Two, motion of expectation. Three, aversion to loss. Four, diminishing sensitivity. Five, satiation. And six, presentism. So let's step through these, if you will, one at a time, and have you explain what you're getting at in each. Would that be okay?
Yes, or we could take one or two and talk in length about it and see how they would apply to our life. Yes, we
okay.
could.
Well, let's see how it goes. I think we
yes.
have plenty of time.
Okay, all right. Okay, so for example, our first law, which is really very simple, it is happiness is reality minus expectations. So let me little bit elaborate on that. If you look at our lives in developed countries like United States, then compared to our ancestors, we have so much more: running water, electricity, cars, roads. So our happiness should be off the chart. We should be all amazingly happy.
Yes.
If reality is the only thing that mattered, reality means what we have. But we have gotten accustomed to these privileges. So our equation simply is saying that happiness is not just dependent, it's not absolute in terms of reality, but it is also depends on your expectations. And reality minus expectations defines that in a precise way. Now, this people kind of from common sense know that, but its implications are very interesting. So, but nevertheless, let me stay a little bit with reality minus expectations. What determines expectations? So one thing is the social comparison or peer group comparison. Now, there is a well-known research which says that in Olympics, bronze medalists are happier than silver medalists. Now, if you think about it, the reality of silver, yes, silver medalists is higher than bronze. Because silver medalists regret missing out gold. Expectation, reality minus expectation. And bronze medalists compare themselves with rest of the field and are happy to win any medal at all.
Yeah, they say, at least I didn't come in last.
right. So this is, you know, they have done a lot of research and collected a lot of data to show that. And so happiness is reality minus expectation. It does not only depend. So, but yet we, daily life, we try to say that if we only had more money or better car or better house, well, you see, so that improves reality and that is fine. But remember that expectations also move up and then you could be exactly at the same level. If I think of my own life, when I was in engineering college, me and my friends, we were riding bicycle and we were happy. And then upon graduation, I bought a scooter and I got used to that and I was happy then. And when I came to UCLA as a PhD student, I bought an old car for $100. And that car actually sometimes refused to reverse.
Yeah. Oh,
so you can imagine how the parking was.
Yeah,
because knowing the next day it may not may not reverse. But I was happy with that car. Actually, my girlfriend then is my wife now for over 30 years, right?
Yeah.
So in spite of that car.
Right. And so the first law is relative comparison. So I assume that gets at not only comparing to your past states, but also there's always somebody who's got better, right?
Right.
So that can dampen our happiness, right? If we're sort of at the top of the heap among the people that we know, we feel affluent and maybe we feel really good. If we're at the bottom of the heap of people that we know, we don't feel so great.
Right. But you see, what happens, Dave, is our expectations keep changing. So even if we reach the top of the heap, I have to give you it is a bit of an exaggeration, but philosopher Russell said that if you desire glory, you will envy Napoleon. But Napoleon envied Caesar, and Caesar envied Alexander. And Alexander envied Hercules, who never existed. So you see, the fame and fortune, you know, it feels like we all feel that if we only had more money, or if we are more well-known or higher on the heap, we will be happier. And it does influence happiness, but for a short while. And again, we come back to the same level. So really, it requires more work than simply trying to improve the reality. And we are for improving. We are in business school. We are business school professors. We want people to improve their reality, advance in their jobs, do well. But that alone is not going to bring happiness, because we get used to that. So we have to see some other ways to improve happiness.
Yes, so the first two laws are relative comparison, motion of expectation, and I think you've been speaking to both of those.
Yes, because I'm combining the two
yes.
in terms of their effect, right? And some of these, you started talking about the social comparison. You know, they have biological consequences. So a study done at UCLA showed that with vervet monkeys, the dominant monkey had a higher level of neurotransmitter serotonin. That is associated with the positive feelings. And when that monkey is removed from the cage, its serotonin level falls and a new monkey becomes dominant and its serotonin level increases. So social comparisons, psychologist Festinger said that this is the way we evaluate how we are doing. So it is normal to have social comparison. What we are trying to say is that the toxic social comparisons, every time a Bentley or some better car comes next to you, you start saying, if I had that car, because you don't know if the guy sitting in that car is so happy himself. No. So these kinds of unnecessary social comparisons are not good. Some social comparisons have to be there. They are just there. They are built in, through our evolution. So the question is, we have to manage these social comparisons.
Now, your third law is aversion to loss, and that probably doesn't need any explanation. It's pretty clear. Your fourth and fifth are, fourth is diminishing sensitivity, and five is satiation. And in a way, those sound similar to me.
Right. So diminishing sensitivity and satiation are very similar. Idea in diminishing sensitivity is that each increment in income or in some other material possession does not give you the same amount, proportional amount of happiness, right? So, for example, if you have $100 versus you win $100 in an office raffle versus $200, then going from 100 to 200 is not does not give you twice as much happiness. So there is a diminishing sensitivity. But over time, satiation, what it means is that over time, if we, it's easiest example is if we are having pizza every day, then on the fourth or fifth day, we would not like it as much, right? But beyond just food, even in our daily life, sometimes it becomes routine. Relationships become routine and people take it for granted and this boredom and dullness sets in. So the law of satiation basically says that there is a diminishing quality to these experiences, and then we can get into how do we conquer the effects of satiation by adding novelty, variety, surprises, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now your sixth law, I think maybe you invented a word. It's called presentism.
Right. So this law basically, you know, Daniel Gilbert has written a whole book on stumbling on happiness, and it is really, we were motivated to use this as a law from his work. And there are other economists who have done work on this. And the idea is that in projecting our future feelings, we overweight our current feelings. So if I feel I want to get a new car or a bigger house, and I have a smaller house now, then I overweight how happy I will be once I get that bigger house. And I fail to project that I'll get adapted to it and the happiness will be short-lived. So presentism basically says that, you know, the clearest example is that researchers have shown that when we go shopping, we buy more for next week's grocery when we are hungry, and we buy less when we are not hungry, because we are projecting our hungry state into next week, and we end up buying more. That law, the reason we made it law is because it's applied to life choices, it could create some life imbalance. And we may emphasize certain things because we think those things will give us happy, when the fact is that it is other sorts of things, like a relationship with friends and family, spiritual improvement. Those are the things that are going to give us happiness rather than acquisition of material goods. So because of presentism, this kind of imbalance could occur. And we, of course, it's a mathematical result, but not in the book. Book, we describe it using stories and examples.
Mm-hmm. Well, the word presentism makes me think of the of being in the present, which, for example, Zen Buddhism advocates that we live in the present, that if we're, you know, that we have a real tendency to either be fantasizing about future successes or disasters, or dwelling upon past disasters, and that the key to happiness is to be right here in the present from right. moment to moment. Is that part of what you're conveying in the work?
No, not in this. Even though I agree with you that living in present, as Buddhist teachings say, is a good thing for happiness. But presentism here is used more as a, if I were to use in our, frankly, in our scientific papers, in our scientific journals, we use a different word. We use the word projection bias. That means when we are making when we are, because all our decisions are based on what will, what kind of happiness will they bring to us in the future, and we make wrong decisions because we are not able to project our future feelings very well. So the presentism word here is used for projection bias rather than the kind of living in the present that you are talking about, because that one we favor. whereas projection bias, it is just there, so there's nothing to favor or not favor, but one should be aware that because of that, we could make wrong decisions or the decisions we don't want to make.
Yeah. Now, you and your co-author actually come up with a mathematical formula for happiness, and I guess there is a rather simple version of the formula. What's that formula?
So basically, the formula basically begins with this reality minus expectation, and we add on to these issues of satiation and shifting expectations and social comparisons. But really what comes out of it is that in our life, and I'll give you a few examples, we should use what we call a crescendo strategy, which is less to more. So let's take a first very simple example, like if it is a vacation, then in the vacation, we should try to see the more spectacular sights towards the end of the trip rather than in the beginning. And again, the reason is because if our expectations go up too quickly, then the subsequent sites we will not enjoy so much. In raising children, we should not give them too much too fast. Now, even in organizations, if you give service employees, it's not true for every group of employees, but call center service employees, more frequent promotions associated with achieving some well-defined goals, that will improve satisfaction. Now, everyone will be familiar with karate, where they actually use this crescendo strategy by awarding different colors of belts as students progress. Now, you see, but more importantly, we feel that as a philosophy of life, you can work to organize the chapters in your book of life in less to more manner. That is, follow a crescendo strategy. So even though, Dave, it is a mathematical result, but one can support it by common sense, that if expectations move and we consume way too much too soon, then our expectations will go up. And it is hard to then keep up with it. We have to work even harder to continue to meet those expectations. Now, we are not against occasional indulgence in something extravagant. That's okay, but not as a habit. We feel life should be organized in less to more way. And that's a clear result from these laws.
That's an interesting thing to contemplate and to think about how it would apply in different situations. So there's some wisdom behind the notion that we should eat dessert after the meal rather than at the beginning.
Right. So for some things, Dave, this is naturally, it happens naturally. But for other things, we just have to think about it a little bit and not rush to get for everything the newest model of either iPad or, you know, if we needed that, it's fine. So it is not like for everything we are saying, but for lots of things, we have a tendency to acquire things too quickly, and it keeps raising our expectations, and then nothing seems to be enough. So, and you know, even the principle of frugality is consistent with it. So, of course, politicians will say we shouldn't be too frugal because we want economy to work and spend our money. But for personal happiness, it is good to be managing these things.
Mm-hmm. Is it real? Some people are going to wonder if it's realistic to think that something as complex as human happiness can submit to a mathematical formula.
Right. So I think that is a fair question. But mathematical formula, you see, if you view it mathematical formula that you could input something and out comes some clear prescription, and that will make you happy. Yes, then I would say that the doubt is correct. But if you could use that mathematical idea and see what can I learn from it. So let's just stay with reality minus expectation. That's we put it down in a mathematical idea. Well, then why don't we look at the way to improve happiness is that why don't we look at those things in our life for which expectation does not change much, or which are less susceptible to social comparison, right? Because if expectations does not move too much, then we can improve our happiness by having that experience or consuming that good again and again. So what I would say is that basic goods, what we call as basic goods, are the ones that are treasure of happiness. Because for basic goods, we do not compare with other people. Easiest example, again, is the needs of the body, which is food. So we enjoy our meal every day when we are hungry. But you see, now I like my phone, but I have gotten used to my cell phone. So I don't say, wow, what a great thing it is. It is just a privilege I'm accustomed to. Now, similarly, you have the needs of the mind and the needs of the heart. These are things like spending time with friends and family, listening to music we love. And these are the sorts of things that give us happiness on a consistent basis. So again, I would say it is not the equation. The equation is just a way of thinking about it, that if our expectation move, then if these are adaptive goods, we better organize in a less to more way. And if these are basic goods, then we begin to emphasize those basic goods in our life and put less emphasis on these adaptive and social comparison and show-off type of goods and activities. So that would be the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think that the real utility of a mathematical approach might not be as much on the individual level as in maybe helping to drive public policy, just as economics can be very, very mathematical and is used in public policy. And of course, the example of Bhutan and their measure of what is it, gross domestic happiness or net Mm-hmm. I'm forgetting.
Gross national happiness.
Gross national happiness. So is that what you would be the your hope of how a mathematical approach would be used?
So what I would say is in public policy, it is useful. But frankly, I would also say that even individual, not so much the mathematics of it, but the organizing principle one could use and say, okay, now this equation is telling me that if I try to go more for money, which means I have to work harder, and for fame, which is I want to do better than my peers. And some of those are desirable things. So we are not against those, but excessive emphasis on that. Then the equation is telling me that my expectations, I be forewarned, my expectations will also shift, and the net result may not be there. Or if I went too far in these achievement of professional and material goals, maybe I will look back and feel that I did not live a good life. In fact, I can quote to you from a very well-known scientist. His name is Chandrasekhar, and he went on to express discontent with his life despite his extraordinarily successful career. Regret that he had imposed his obsessional lifestyle on his wife, and chagrin that his life has been so one-sided, so lonely, so inescapable. Now, see, it is sobering to hear such discontent from a Nobel laureate whose achievements are so celebrated that his name graces a space satellite. So the point is that this trade-off between personal and professional life, and we are not saying what is the right trade-off for an individual. If somebody wants to be all the time in the lab and do that, that's good if that's what you want to do. But this comment shows that Chandrasekhar was not happy and it just happened to him. And that is because we are not proactive in our choices. We are reactive. So life is like a river. It will, with many branches, it will just take us to the main flow, and the main flow tends to be in the direction of our jobs and our career at the expense of personal life. That apparently happened to him. So a proper balance, once in a while, being proactive about our choice, what is it we want to do, what kind of life we want to lead, and that would be different for different people. The emphasis on the professional side, personal side, on community activity side, hobbies, would be different for different people. The point we are making is that if you do not think about it, you might end up going too far in one direction.
Yeah, you talk about happiness traps and happiness triggers, and maybe that's what you're getting at now. What are some of the happiness traps and the happiness triggers?
So the biggest happiness trap is overemphasis on peer group comparison or social comparison, and trying to go for adaptive goods, not recognizing that the happiness that we get from these material goods is short-lived. The happiness trigger is basically, if you look at the research, that the single most important factor in happiness is the time spent with friend and family and pursuing some hobby or pursuing your passion. And those are the things that make people happy. And in our cumulative good chapter, Dave, we talk about a strategy in which you begin to see reality in a different way. There is no one truth out there. We have a choice in interpreting the reality. So there is a well-known parable where a traveler comes upon across a group of hard at work stonemasons. And let's say one stonemason is John, and he tells the traveler that I'm constructing a wall. And another one is Paul, and Paul says, I'm building a cathedral. Now, Paul sees a greater purpose and meaning in his daily work. So reality is the same. Paul, too, is sending a stone or digging a foundation or constructing a wall, but he sees a greater purpose. And now you can see your reality in a cumulative way. You are planting something. It's a bit of a hassle versus cultivating a garden. You are taking care of children, taking them to the school, or asking them to do homework. All that could be stressful, actually, but you could think of it as raising a family. You could think of a job and day-to-day hassles, or you can think of it as a career. So with cumulative goods, what we say is that your actions and activities are not disconnected. And that is why progressing toward goals, for example, earlier, Dave, you were saying in political activism or helping in environmental causes, and in some causes that transcend us, whatever they are going to be different for different people. Developing relationships are ways to be happy, because we are gradually filling the metaphorical bucket. So the thing is, this is our choice, how we view our life. And what we feel is that if you view things in take a broader view of life, you know, day-to-day annoyances are there for everybody. But if you take a broader view of life, then you diminish the negative effect of these day-to-day annoyances.
Okay. Well, you know, after the initial rush of enthusiasm, many of the findings and claims of positive psychology are coming under critical examination. I have to confess that I was really caught up in, in the enthusiasm of the movement. So, for example, I wonder if you've seen the current issue of the American Psychologist. There's an article in there where the authors present a contextual view, which is to say that the outcome of practices that are supposed to lead to a happy ending may turn out to be positive or negative depending upon their social context. They give the example of a woman in an abusive marriage. Optimism, forgiveness, gratitude, and positive thinking or reframing may lead her to stay in an unhappy and dangerous situation. And they cite a number of such examples and present research findings to back them up. So it's looking like the happiness question might be a lot more complex than we've been led to believe. What's your response to that?
Right. So, you know, I have not seen this article, but in this particular example, again, there is a choice. You know, we cannot be so for every bad situation where we can get out of it, right? We don't have to make a choice of seeing only the positive side as if we have that's the only choice we have. So, yes. So in this example, I would say maybe another choice is to get out of this relationship, even though there is some insecurity, right? In the what would I do if I get out of it? If somebody may be financially dependent or whatever, so that we will not support that you take if you have an abusive situation or a work environment is harassing you or creating a lot of stress in you, just see the positive side and tolerate it. We feel that you have a choice. You have a choice to get out. in fact, we will feel the other way, that your overall life is improved by getting out of these bad situations and take the short-term loss, because yes, getting out sometimes is not easy, but in the longer run, you may come out ahead.
Yeah, I guess it's a it sort of sounds a warning against adopting a set of rules in a kind of almost like religious no exception kind of way, you know,
right,
doctrinaire kind of way, which we seem to have a tendency to want to do, to simplify life and to just have a nice set of rules. And, you know, so I must always think positive. I must always be full of gratitude. I must always find the positive aspect of the situation. No, we need more flexibility than that.
Right, right. You are totally right. We need more flexibility. And we always have to keep in mind we have a choice, you see. So sometimes it is good to make the other choice.
Yes.
And that's difficult. Sometimes people get stuck in a job for so long, the job they did not like. And because every point in time when you say, if I give up, then what will I do next? Because unless you give it up, you do not know what else lies out there. Because some people are lucky. They can find and line up something first and then leave. That's of course, but sometimes that's not possible. Or somebody who wants to do a business now, we do not know when he starts a business what will come out. So at some point you have to gather strength and say, that's my passion and I have to go for that, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're a professor at UCLA, which is not an easy place to get into and not an easy place to stay in. There are lots of pressures and so on. What do you do to keep your life in balance?
Yes, so I feel very lucky because in academic life, I love the academic life. I get to do my research. I enjoy teaching students, and for my pleasure, I play golf with my friends, and that's a source of joy because it is not just the exercise part, but also getting together once a week with friends. Some of these friends I have are for more than 30 years. So I enjoy that. Yes, I feel I'm frankly lucky to be a UCLA professor.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, you know, I hear a warmth in your voice and humor that says to me that, in fact, you're doing a good job of applying your six laws and that you're keeping your life in balance. So as we wind down here, I wonder if there's anything you'd like to add.
So I usually tell my students that when one looks at life, we are all juggling many balls. It could be career, family, it could be church activities, hobbies, political activism. We are juggling many balls, going to the classes or whatever. And once in a while, a ball will drop and it bounces back. It's not a big deal. But I always tell students that one of these balls has a basic good, what I earlier described, a basic good. And that ball is the crystal ball. And one should not let that crystal ball is your friends and family. And one should not let that ball drop.
Oh, that's a wonderful close for us here. Dr. Rakesh Sareen, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, Dave. I really enjoyed our conversations.
Well, I hope this conversation with Dr. Rakesh Sareen added a few happy dons to your lifetime total. The happy don, in case you didn't catch it, is the theoretical unit of happiness measurement that the authors propose. Although the authors are engineers by training, I really have to compliment them on their wide-ranging study of the happiness literature and their very approachable, non-technical writing style. If you're looking for a good overview of the happiness literature coming out of positive psychology, this would be an excellent place to start. I continue to be interested in both the positive claims and forward movement of positive psychology, along with the critiques that the movement is spawning. You can expect to hear me continuing to cover both in future episodes as I strive to find my own balance point in relation to the claims and counterclaims of this emerging field.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hello again, everyone. Well, Dr. Rakesh Sareen has reminded us that money does not equal happiness, at least not once you've gotten past a certain level. There are many non-monetary rewards for me in doing these podcasts, and at the same time, the income this work generates is at the very least symbolically important to me. In case you think Shrink Wrap Radio is so popular that there must be a lot of money rolling in, I can tell you that for the month of February, we received a total of $335, and that's before PayPal takes out their bit of flesh. Don't get me wrong, I am grateful for the $335 and thank all of you who made that possible. At the same time, I think I deserve a raise. As I've said in the past, each episode represents at least 10 hours. So 4 episodes in a month would mean 40 hours a month, which means that February brought in about $8 an hour. And that's before we subtract the $20 a month to keep our iPhone and Android apps available for you, and the $25 a month we're paying for hosting. So if you haven't already done so, please become a financial supporter by clicking on that big green donate button at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, believe it or not, I don't feel terribly comfortable making these pitches for financial support. So here's another way you could help. It would be really cool if some of you with the skill to do so would create some engaging audio commercials for me. They should probably be no longer than a minute long. Let's see what you can come up with. You can record on my message line at 206-337-0622, or you can send me an audio clip, or you can use your smartphone to record it and send it via email, or if you have our Apple iPhone or Android app, you can leave a message that way. Let me remind you that the International Association for the Study of Dreams is holding its 29th annual international conference, Sailing the Sea of Dreams, at the Berkeley Marina DoubleTree this year, June 22nd through the 26th. It's a 4.5-day event open to the public with over 170 presenters from around the globe offering workshops, lectures, panels, and special events. You'll hear me interview 2 or 3 presenters here prior to the event. To find out more, you can go to www.asdreams.org for information and to register. If you have a smartphone and you don't have our app, do check out the app tab at the top of the Shrink Wrap Radio page. Finally, I've added a Google Plus One icon in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com. I'm in the process of trying to figure out Google Plus. At any rate, I'd really appreciate it if you'd plus one us there. Thanks.
Hi, this is Art Cervantes from the San Francisco Apple Store, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
The new iPad comes out tomorrow, or maybe today when you hear this on Friday. I am not in San Francisco. Actually, this clip I recorded probably 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, but I thought it would be an appropriate one given the emergence of the iPad 3. Now let's listen to a few recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Sana, who posted on our Facebook fan page, which you can find most easily by clicking on the Facebook icon at the top of the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com. And Sana writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm currently working on my thesis with the field of positive psychology and have had much use of many of your excellent interviews. So first of all, thank you so much for all your hard work. Secondly, in my research, I've come across Julie Norum and her studies of defensive pessimism and her message of the power of negative thinking. I'm sure you have plenty of guests for your shows, for I think she would make a wonderful guest on your show. Best regards from Copenhagen, Denmark." So, Sana, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, thanks so much for that suggestion. I, in fact, have a surfeit, that is, so many suggestions for guests, but And I had not heard of Julie Norum, but she's right on target for, you know, the kinds of podcasts that I'm doing recently on positive psychology. So thank you very much for that suggestion, and I'll look right into her, okay? Next, we hear from Cheryl, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been a faithful listener for almost 3+ years. I'm working on my master's degree to become a licensed professional counselor and art therapist. As a student who has returned to college after my children have married, your podcasts have made a world of difference in my success and understanding of my college coursework. Thank you." Thank you. I'm really glad to hear that. She goes on to say, "I'm currently doing research for an ethics course on the subject of battering, and I cannot remember the title of an episode. It was the one which focused on the clinician who provided his therapeutic services for people who in turn had to do a certain number of community service hours as their payment for therapy. I've searched the show titles and can't seem to find it. If you recall the show number or title and would send it to me, that would be wonderful." In fact, I did send it to Cheryl, and it was an episode from the early days of Wise Counsel, describing the VIP program in Boston. And VIP stood for Volunteers in Psychotherapy. Cheryl goes on to say, "I shared links to your shows on my college's Facebook page, and I also tell all the professionals at the VA Hospital's mental health facility in Prescott, Arizona, where I'm interning, about the great content that you're making available. Every time I listen to your show, I remind myself that it's my plan to make a donation to your show once I actually have an income. Please keep up the outstanding work. I won't be a student forever. With deep appreciation, Cheryl." Okay, Cheryl, I'm going to hold you to that. And thanks so much for helping to tell other people about the show and for your gratitude that you've expressed in this message. Okay, the next one is from Don, who wrote in response to my thanks for his donation. And Don writes, "Dr. Dave, better late than never, or so they say. I've been a longtime listener and free rider. I just didn't get around to showing my appreciation, and shame on me. I have a 45-minute or more drive twice a day. That time is spent educating myself in a wide range of podcasts, from Astronomy Cast to Econ Talk to, of course, Shrink Wrap Radio, and many, many more. Your work is at the top of my list due to the gentle delivery, wide diversity, and out-of-the-box ideas. Some of my favorite shows include Active Imagination with Monica Wickman, Secret Lives of the Brain with David Eagleman, Mindful Sleep with Ruben Neiman, and Neuroscience of Happiness with Rick Hansen. Those are all great ones, I must say. He goes on to say, "I seem to favor the scientific-leaning interviews, perhaps due to my IT work in the area of cancer research. I would be curious to know what podcasts you listen to, if any, and where you get your inspirations and interview techniques. I'd love to point you toward a scientific podcast on the brain called The Brain Science Podcast with Dr. Ginger Campbell. Sincerely, Donald." Well, I responded to Donald and let him know that I know at least virtually Dr. Ginger Campbell. We communicate via email. And in fact, I'm one of the contributors to her science podcasters show, and it reminds me that I haven't contributed anything in some time, but I sometimes repost the more scientifically oriented interviews there. In terms of the podcasts I listen to, I'm a little embarrassed to say that I don't listen to a whole lot of podcasts. I actually listen to a lot of fiction that I download from audible.com. And let's see, what I do listen to tends to be Macintosh and oriented. I listen to MacBreak Weekly, and I listen to Today in iOS podcast. And let's see, I also sometimes listen to All in the Mind, which comes out of Australia. And there are a few others that I like The Moth very much. And This American Life. But, you know, I spend so much time reading the books of the people that I interview that, you know, I get my fill of psychology, so I'm not really listening to other psychology podcasts. And also, I'm afraid that I would get discouraged if I hear people that are doing a better job than I am. So I keep my nose to the grindstone and my blinders on, which probably isn't a great idea. As for your question about my interview skills and where they come from, I think they mostly flow from my personality and probably also from my training as a clinical psychologist, and even more so from my experience as a focus group moderator in my market research consulting work. The next one is a comment posted on the site by Evan of livingauthentically.org, and he was commenting on number 296, Critiquing Positive Psychology as Cancer Treatment with James Coyne. And Evan writes, "This interview and your comments highlight the difference between research and clinical experience. Research can only deal with generalities, but the clinician is concerned with individuals. The research is concerned with the objective, for example, length of life, but the clinician with the subjective, for example, helping the client feel good. The researcher's perspective dealing with generalities ignores the outliers. For example, in fitness, those who don't receive the benefit from exercise get lost in the averages. But to these individuals and to the clinicians that deal with them, the generalities are utterly relevant. How I do agree with," and he quotes, "to the extent it is useful, it is not new, and to the extent that it is new, it is not very helpful," end quote. "I don't know anything in positive psychology that wasn't anticipated by the third force psychologies and therapies." And of course, Evan, I agree with you wholeheartedly, which is why I'm reading this comment here now. So once again, I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to me, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And in addition to emails, you can leave your comments, as Evan did, about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622, or you can use our iPhone and or Android app to leave a voice message as well. Thanks again to Dr. Rakesh Sareen for sharing his perspective on engineering happiness. My next episode will feature an interview with Jungian analyst Dr. John Beebe, MD, who has been on the show twice before. We'll be discussing the David Cronenberg film, A Dangerous Method. If you haven't seen this film yet, I suggest you try to search it out. Either way, however, I think you'll find Dr. Beebe to have a wealth of fascinating observations. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.